I put together a group of poems based on dreams. And in our dream group, let's see, here we go. I don't know whether everybody can see that or not. Could maybe try to make it larger. So does everybody here understand the difference that Carl Jung made between big dreams and little dreams? He drew from the Nazcapi Indians, the Nazcapi Indians of the Labrador Peninsula that he never visited, by the way, said, oh, here we go, okay. That's a little bit more visible. Said that there is a spiritual being who is available to all of us, but especially in our dreams at night. And his name is Mr. Peo, the million-year-old man. So if ever you don't know the answer to a question, don't throw your hands up and give up. Ask Mr. Peo, the million-year-old man. He knows the answer. And so Carl Jung borrowed that from shamanism, and he said, the million-year-old man is the one who sends us the somnia ad Deo missa. That's a Latin term from the Middle Ages. The dreams sent by God. And the phrase I've been waking up with in the morning these days, it's almost like a little prayer, is the Latin phrase that is carved over the door of Jung's house in Küsnacht. Still can be visited, I think. It says, vocatus atque non vocatus Deus aderit. Vocatus atque non vocatus Deus aderit. Called or not called, God is present, or God comes. So, dreams a portal to the source. I'm now going to tell a slightly risque story. It's the story of when Edward C. Whitmont, the dreams a portal to the source guy, so basically he was saying the same thing as Jung, that there are big dreams and little dreams. Little dreams are all about the things you experience every day. Oh, I've got to get to class, and there's a roadblock in the way, and the bus hasn't come. Oh, a bunch of relatives just came to visit and we have nothing to eat, you know, so that kind of, those are little dreams. They often still are worth exploring, but the big dreams come with a certain kind of solemnity and sometimes they tell you things. Anybody have a voice in their dream that actually says things? Anybody have that? I mean, you'll hear dictation and you'll be given messages. I'm going to give an example from my own dream journal that I have here, by the way. So big dreams are the somnia ad Deo missa, the dreams sent by God. And that's what the Nazcapi say. That's the million-year-old man. They don't have the same exact word as God, but that's what they mean. And so here's the risque story. Christopher Whitmont is fleeing Austria to get away from the Nazis, and he goes to visit Jung in Switzerland, and he wants to get some analytic sessions. Jung would occasionally give talented young psychiatrists, he was particularly interested in the MD variety, give them a few sessions, not free, we'd charge them, but he'd give them a few sessions to train them, and that's what he agreed to do for Whitmont. And of course they had to bring a dream. Well, Whitmont is sleeping in a little pension in Zurich, he didn't have very much money, couldn't afford very much, and that night he dreams, and he dreams that he goes to Jung's office in his house at Küsnacht, and he's sitting in the waiting room for a while, nobody there. So finally, he gets really restless, and he's looking at his watch. He peeks around the corner. There's nobody in the office, but they had an appointment for 11 o'clock in the morning. And then he hears a mighty sound coming from a room in back of the office. And he realizes it's the bathroom, and somebody is taking a mighty shit in there. And it's very, very audible, and it's smellable as well. And then comes finally the welcome sound of flushing and hand washing, and there comes Jung out of the back room, smiling at him, and saying, "Oh yes, just nature has priority and called me, you know." And Whitmont wakes up. Now here's his predicament. He has to tell Jung the dream. So he comes in the next morning a little sheepishly, and Jung is not in the bathroom. He's actually there as he's supposed to be. And Whitmont is a little fellow. He's about 5'3" or 5'4". And Jung is 6'3". And whenever Freud would faint from one of their conversations, Jung could carry him around like a child. He was a big Swiss peasant, and that was one of the reasons that Freud resented Jung. That he was just physically overwhelming to Freud in some ways. Freud was a city dweller. So Whitmont trepidatiously tells Jung the dream, and Jung's eyes get wider and wider. And then he starts to laugh uproariously. And he says, "Oh, great!" He says, "Now we can work together." Now, if you doubt the meaning of what that story is all about and why Jung said that, read Deirdre Baer's biography. Several people I recommended it to in Pendle Hill, and they've done it. Anybody here read Deirdre Baer's 900 page biography? Very, very, very thorough. Carl Jung will never be the same for you again. And you understand exactly what Whitmont's dream was about, because Jung was the guy who invented a shadow. Why shouldn't he have a big one? And he did. Who saw A Dangerous Method, by the way? Oh, good. I don't know whether we have time to talk about it at some point, but Robin and I wanted to be there, but we were just exhausted and we couldn't get out, and I do apologize.
We didn't show it in the end.
Oh, you didn't show it?
No, we only had time for the first movie, The Cave.
Oh, okay.
So, a lot of people have seen that.
Yeah. Now, the pivotal player in that movie is Sabina Spielrein. This is the Russian Jewess, brilliant Russian Jewess, who came to Switzerland to be healed. She was in a series of mental hospitals. She finally ended up at the Burghölzli with Eugen Bleuler. And Jung was assigned as her analyst, and he did a pretty decent job. He did such a good job that she became his clinical lab assistant for the word association experiments, and she had to keep accurate records and do all that kind of thing. Now, what it then shows in the movie is that she has been sexually molested by her father, physically beaten by her father, and she can't get sexually aroused until somebody spanks her. And so there are these many scenes. They're artfully rendered. You look up into one of those stuffy Swiss houses, and you're looking at the end window, and something violent is going on in there, and then you finally come into the room and you realize that Jung is spanking his patient. It's called the repetition compulsion. And guess what that spanking leads to?
Sex.
Yeah, not sex. No, they just dancing.
Hot sex. Yes, right. She said.
And yes, it led to hot sex. And so when I was in Zurich looking desperately, because I had a reputation of being a local Jung guy, I was looking to see if there wasn't really any truth to Jung's relationship with the Nazis, and I didn't really find anything, and certainly not in the library there. And I've since researched it, and there's not really too much to it. People adapted his idea of the collective unconscious to the racial Aryan thing, and a distant relative of Jung was in the Goebbels family, And Jung was the president of the German Psychoanalytical Association for a while. They had already rejected Freud because he was Jewish. And so that's how the rumors got started. I didn't really find that, but I found the letters that Frau Spielrein had written to Carl Jung. And they start out with great appreciation. Dear Dr. Jung, thank you for curing my daughter, but I think that your relationship with her now is hardly proper. And this is the early days of psychoanalysis. There weren't any boards of ethics or rules or anything like that. They were in the process of being made through things like the story I'm telling you. What I did find was the not only that letter, but Jung's reply. And Jung wrote back to her saying, "Dear Frau Spielrein," she was staying in Zurich at that time, "you should be proud and glad that such a distinguished person as myself is stooping your daughter." what do they call that in Yiddish? Chutzpah, right? He certainly had chutzpah. He was not ashamed. Gall. He was sort of proud of himself. In any case, I still rely immensely upon Carl Jung. He was an original, brilliant genius, and he said, "In the middle of my life, I had to figure out my task of tasks to find out what myth I was living. And those myths are extracted from dreams." And here's an easy way of thinking about this. A myth is a public dream. A dream is a private myth. They come from the same deep source, that well of the creative unconscious. A dream is a private myth. A myth is a private dream. So when I set out to write the book, The Mythic Imagination, which I've seen a few of you brandishing about here, I based that on 20 years of 3,000 dreams that I collected from my patients. And instead of making it up myself, I went through the dream for themes. And by God, I found them. And the chapters in the book are all organized around the dreams of my patients. So I let them dictate the shape of the book. And there were lots and lots of big dreams mixed in with the little dreams. Among other things, think about the archetypes in your own dreams for just a moment. How many of you frequently dream of the home or place of your childhood where you haven't been for dozens of decades? Anybody? Okay. How many of you dream of that little fort that you made with your friends in the woods and first started to learn to imagine together? How many of you dream of the attic or the basement in your parents' house? Both usually haunted, full of whispers and suggestions and ideas. How many of you dream of being on stage and you don't know your lines?
Or teaching, yeah.
How many of you dream about being on an impossible journey and you're trying to get somewhere and you never get there? Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is, if it's the bathroom that you're seeking, please don't find it in your dream. You know why? Because it's prompted by a full bladder. And if you find it in your dream and you go, "Oh, what a relief, I can let everything go," that's a problem. So as Freud says, Freud was brilliant about this. He said, if you continue looking, you'll hold your water, not let it go. So the dream arises in response, a simple response to a physiological problem. And don't worry, you'll get over it. How many of you dream about animals? And I have a whole chapter in The Mythic Imagination on animals, and it's an inventory of animals. I based it on one dreamer who, she's walking down the road and she goes to her city park, and all of a sudden she notices that there's a couple of anacondas and boa constrictors hanging from the trees. And she goes, "What the hell? Isn't this Saratoga Springs, New York?" And she walks into the park, and every kind of animal in the world is in that park. It's called the Animal Park Dream. Anybody have that? The animals are all there. It's not a zoo. They're walking around and they're kind of on their own. So the animals are, as Joseph Campbell called it, the way of the animal powers, the oldest stratum of our mythic imagination. And you saw that there in Herzog's film, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Really beautiful film. So the animals are there. How many of you dream about a wise old man or woman? How many of you dream about a trickster or an evil clown who laughs at you, like the Joker in Batman? Okay. He needs more work, by the way. Is the unexpected element in the dreaming. So these are just some of the archetypes that came up in people's dreams, and I fashioned the book around those. Also, masks come up. And the, in fact, the book starts with a mask. Dream was, I look at my face in a mirror, and I seem to be wearing a mask. And I say, well, I've got to take it off. There's another mask underneath. Okay, I take that one off. Oh, there's another one underneath. Oh, another one underneath. My friend Jeff McBride, the magician, has anybody ever seen him perform? We almost put in a picture of him in this thing because he says he based his biggest act in Las Vegas on my book, The Mythic Imagination. And in that